Saturday with Colm O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Still here with me in studio are Vincent Durack, Associate Professor of Middle East Politics in UCD, and also Peter Power, Executive Director of UNICEF Ireland. We'll hear more from them in just a moment. But before we do, I want to turn to the events of October 7th last year, specifically what unfolded along the border between Gaza and Israel when Hamas launched its attack on Israel, killing 1,100 people and taking over 200 hostages, 97 of whom are believed to be still in Gaza. One of those was 35-year-old Sagi Dekel-Khen. I've been speaking to his father, Jonathan, and he began by recounting what happened in their kibbutz that morning.
The kibbutz was essentially invaded by about 200 heavily armed, well-trained Hamas terrorists at around 6:30 in the morning that day, after a massive barrage of rockets and mortar fire into the kibbutz, the whole region, really. My son, as was his habit, on Saturday mornings and holiday mornings, was not at home with his wife and daughters. He was a couple hundred meters away in our kibbutz machine shop. He was one of the first people who saw a group of terrorists infiltrate the kibbutz, and he and others who were up that early put out the alarm to the kibbutz to tell everyone to shelter. And the security team, the small civilian security team of the kibbutz, was also activated, and the call went out to the army, to let the Israeli army, to let them know that the kibbutz had been infiltrated by terrorists. During the course of the next 3 hours or so, Sagi did what he could with other young men and not so young men from the kibbutz to try to defend, but mostly assess what was going on. Somewhere around 9:30 in the morning, Sagi was taken hostage, wounded, and was transported along with 78 other people from our kibbutz to Gaza. That morning, 51 of our community of 400, 51 were murdered. And we're talking about men, women, and children. There were no soldiers there. So from 2-year-olds to 85-year-olds were butchered in and outside of their homes. And our small community was completely destroyed. We know now, or we've known since late November, early December, that at that time, Sagi was still alive. We know that because at the time, if you recall, there was a first negotiated agreement between Israel and Hamas that brought the release of around 100 hostages, women and children. Of those, about 40 were from our kibbutz. Two of the women and a couple of the teenagers who were released were able to tell us that they had seen Sagi a couple of days before their release in the tunnels under Gaza, and he was alive and wounded, but that's many lifetimes ago, late November, early December. So that is what we know.
And what do you know about his whereabouts at that time, insofar as the hostages who were released were able to tell that? Was he in a tunnel? Was he in a building above ground?
They encountered him in a tunnel. They assume, but they don't really know, under Khan Yunis. The tragedy, of course, is that the fact that someone was still alive in Hamas captivity in November or December means nothing in terms of their ability to survive.
Amidst all of this, wait, you've heard nothing since November when you heard he was still alive in the tunnels under Gaza. He has a wife. He has a very young family. One of his daughters he hasn't seen. Is that the case? How are his family?
Well, they're doing the best they can, as you can imagine. And you're correct. His wife survived miraculously with two little girls in a bomb shelter for 9 hours under siege by Hamas terrorists. At the time, she was 7 months pregnant. Their third daughter was born in December. Our whole community is completely traumatized, Colm.
But in the short term, a ceasefire negotiation, you believe, is necessary to secure the release of hostages. At the moment, the military and even the Israeli defense minister seem in favor of going for a 6-week ceasefire deal to secure the release of more hostages. The prime minister is not prepared at this stage to go along with the deal as it's currently proposed, even to the point, I believe, that the US have said they don't believe he's doing all he can. So where do you find yourself at the moment when you know a deal is potentially in sight and yet it's not been taken up?
Well, Colm, I've been very vocal since January in my criticism of our government and our prime minister. He has shown by his deeds, putting lip service aside, that he absolutely is not prioritizing the lives of our hostages. He has been selling a fantasy in Israel that more and more military pressure will bring eventually the release of the hostages. And we've seen over recent weeks that the only thing that our military pressure is doing is getting hostages killed, murdered by their captors. I've believed for a very long time that the only way to get hostages out of the tunnels, the Hamas tunnels, is through a negotiated agreement. There is no way, there's no army that knows how to get to rescue hostages in large numbers being held underground by terrorists who have no compunction about killing them and are themselves, for the most part, prepared to die. The agreement that's on the table right now is a three-stage agreement that will, the first stage is 6 weeks, but there it continues on, that would include then a ceasefire. And no less importantly, this ceasefire would also end the suffering of the people of Gaza, at least allow them the chance to recover. And here we must remember, and your listeners must remember, this horrific situation was caused by the barbarity of Hamas on October 7th and their unwillingness to return these hostages. Hamas could have ended this on October 8th by returning the hostages last week or, today.
Do you believe that this prime minister can cut a deal?
I think he must. I don't know if he can or he cannot. I know that there are two points of pressure that the world has to be aware of in order to end the madness. Essentially, our prime minister has to be coerced to do this and put aside his narrow political and perhaps personal interests for the sake of the country of Israel. And at the same time, the international community has to increase its pressure on Hamas. These are not good guys. These are not freedom fighters. And the world has been rather forgiving up until now vis-a-vis Hamas.
What's your view of the U.S. role in this, how effective it has been and how effective it could be?
We, meaning the U.S. Hostage families, those of us with dual citizenship in the U.S. and in Israel, have been working with the Biden administration and Congress, really from wall to wall, since the first days after October 7th. I am convinced that the Biden administration, from the very start, has been totally committed to trying what it can do to influence, to pressure both Hamas and Israel to get to yes on one version or another of an agreement between them. Is there enough pressure being applied? Well, I think all in all, we'll know that enough pressure is being applied by all parties when the hostages are home and when the fighting stops.
And that was Jonathan Dekel-Chen, whose son Sagi is missing and unaccounted for since he was abducted by Hamas on the morning of October 7th. Vincent Durack, Associate Professor of Middle East Studies in UCD, is still here with us, as is Peter Power, Executive Director of UNICEF. Vincent Durack, we've talked already about the likelihood of the ceasefire, but who's best placed in the international community to put pressure on Hamas to make sure that the hostages are kept in some fashion or form safe and alive until a deal is cut?
It's a really good question. Hamas are coming under that pressure to the extent that it can be exerted in the first place from a number of quarters, from the Egyptians, but particularly from Qatar. And essentially the reward, if you can speak in those terms, for Hamas would be Israeli withdrawal from Gaza and an end to the day-to-day violence that the people of Gaza have been suffering, as everybody knows. And for Hamas, of course, surviving as an organization is key to their objectives. They're not interested in walking away. So some concession to that is going to be necessary. But who practically can bring that pressure to bear is very difficult to see at the moment. The decision-making in Hamas is so opaque. It always has been, and is particularly now for obvious reasons. It is a very, very muddy picture.
Peter Power, the other, I suppose, potential upshot of this war is it's spilling over into Lebanon. There's about 60,000 Israelis who can't move back to their homes on Israel's northern border, which will increase political pressure on Israel to do something about securing that. But what would the impact of a war in Lebanon be? You're not long back from there.
Yes, I was in southern Lebanon a few weeks ago. First of all, to say, just to repeat what Jonathan said in your interview there, we must always remember that what started this was almost 12 months ago by a barbaric, horrific attack on innocent families, women and children. We should always just keep that in the overall context of the humanitarian.
Sure, and the holding of those hostages is a war crime.
Absolutely. So there have been grave violations, and we've said this consistently, there have been grave violations on both sides. In terms of the wider geopolitical issues, yes, I was in Lebanon only a few weeks ago, and it's a tinderbox. There's no question about it. You can feel it in the air. Already, Lebanon is reeling from multiple crises. It should be said, over a million people, about 20% of their population, has flowed over from Syria. That's caused its own humanitarian crisis on the eastern part of Lebanon. Secondly, the financial crisis, which followed the terrible bombing in Beirut, the explosion in Beirut, rather, has had catastrophic effects on the livelihoods of people. So Lebanon, after many years of relative stability, peace and relative prosperity, is in a very, very difficult situation now. And I couldn't overemphasize the effect of a war between Hezbollah and Israel. We're talking about the weaponry on both sides is just, again, of orders of magnitude greater than what Hamas has. And you were talking about millions of people being affected from as far north as Beirut, from Beirut down to Tyre, right down to the border area. And it would be catastrophic. And once that starts, of course, the concern about a wider conflagration in the entire Middle East is really in play then. So the stakes are extremely high here. And I would repeat what we have said again and again and again. It behoves all parties to the conflict now to seek a peace deal, seek a ceasefire in the interests of hundreds of thousands of people who badly need assistance.
Finally and briefly to you, Vincent Durack, although there has been a conflict going on, rockets have been fired by Hezbollah into Israel. They haven't, I suppose, partaken in this as fully as they could. There seems to be some level of restraint or reluctance on their part.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, there has been persistent launching of rockets from Hezbollah into Israel right up to the last few days. But again, the term that recurs in all of this is calibration. You know, is how far can either side go without provoking the sort of response that might lead exactly to the catastrophic results that Peter has just alluded to. And you know, in terms of the earlier discussion about a ceasefire, it's instructive and worrying that just this week there are reports that Netanyahu has tabled a motion for the security cabinet in Israel, which would place the return of 60,000 people who've left northern Israel as a central aim of the war, which would redirect IDF efforts towards the north. And that then brings about all of those horrible sort of possibilities that we've been talking about.
Okay, that's where we have to leave it for today.